You are listening to a discussion born in the Christian ghetto. Welcome to another episode of the Christian Ghetto Podcast. And I'm very privileged to have on today a number of guests. I have Ben Braddock, Athenian Stranger, John Slaughter, Ron Dodson, and the Black Horse, joining me, Kryptos. And we're going to discuss an issue that is been important to me over the years. And there were some recent tweets over the last couple of weeks that brought it to the forefront. I was listening to a couple of podcasts on formation and education. And I thought, it's about time that we have a conversation about discipleship. There's a lot of talk in this space about, you know, eat well, go lift, and that sort of thing. But there's also the challenges that in a digital space where people are connecting over the internet, all these questions of, you know, how do we bond together? How do we grow together? How do we build something together? And when I look out over the Christian landscape, there is a lot of spaces where people are growing churches and they're teaching people and they're doing classes and so forth. But when I compare to what Jesus did with his disciples in the gospel, in the way that he formed the 12, and what we do today, that I have for quite some time looked at and saw and came to the conclusion that we're not really making disciples, and we haven't for some time. And the historic reasons for that, maybe, you know, the success of Christendom meant that we just didn't do it. We just assumed everybody was going to be Christian. Maybe there's other reasons than this, but we have not for a long time been intentional about forming Christians in the faith, especially men. And I think in many ways we're paying the price for it today. And so I feel blessed too that we have the Gospels, that we can look at Jesus' example. But a lot of it means kind of, I think, rediscovering the art of discipleship. There's pockets of discipleship here and there. There are people that do it well, and there's places that do it well. But I think overall, throughout the Christian community, it's one of these things that there's a lack. And when, like this past week, where you see like the monster truck Christianity, and I look at that and think, well, Christian discipleship is probably whatever, you know, is whatever that isn't, you know, Christian discipleship would probably fill that gap fairly well. So welcome, gentlemen. And, you know, broadly speaking, the categories that when we prepped that I gave to this sort of, you know, what's the difference between, say, in your eyes, maybe a male spirituality, female spirituality? What are some of the practices of, you know, prayer and scripture discipline? Maybe the idea of like hierarchy versus peer mentoring. We could talk about that. The notion of physical fitness and healthy eating, the importance perhaps of all male spaces. And for me, one of these things that I think is important is working with your hands and that connection with what's real. Also the notion of theology and intellectual combat, spiritual warfare, like what does it mean to live a heroic Christian life? And I've often thought that mysticism and the mystical journey is really a male thing more so than a female thing. And then even like crazier perhaps, because we're getting into a world that is more uncertain, where pressures are going to be put on to the Christian faith by the regime, and there's a greater degree of political instability, does something like militia type training have a place in Christian discipleship? So that's my kind of broad list, and I could probably have thrown more things on there, but that was the stuff that I kind of threw out to get everybody thinking. And so I'm just going to open it up to you guys and let whoever wants to step up begin.
Well, I think the first question out of that list to take on is to look at what the difference is in discipling men versus discipling women, because I think a lot of some of these subsequent questions about specific practices kind of begin to fall out when we start to talk about what it is we're trying to accomplish. I think one of the key pieces that you're trying to do when you're trying to intentionally disciple men is you're trying to teach them to be leaders of first their families, then from their, well, first to be self-disciplined, then to become leaders of their families, then from there to become leaders of the small parts of their church that they might be leaders in, then to become leaders of the church proper, and then to become leaders of their broad community. We see that this responsibility for leadership is given to men in Scripture. It's given in different degrees to different men. But I think if you want to identify the place where you've got a different, where you, the place where discipleship is more than just, is specialized for men versus for women, that's the place to look. And so as we talk about some of these other pieces, I think leadership is a key component, and then what does it mean to protect and provide to fulfill those kinds of roles that men would need to fulfill in their families? That's another kind of key piece.
There was one other thing too that I had thought about, Black Horse, in terms of this idea when you mentioned male leadership, is in today's church, oftentimes leadership is seen as a kind of punishment, something that you're, you know, somebody, a chore that is forced upon you that you'd rather not do. And when I was listening to on Burden's show, when Athenian and Bagby were talking together, there was this notion that leadership and ascending should be seen as something that is aspirational, that men should want to aspire to greater things. And among those greater things is to lead in the Christian community. And so I guess that's part of the question is there something that we can do to make Christian leadership aspirational in a good way, and not so much in the sense aspiring just to a grift or something, but real true leadership as something as aspirational and not merely as a chore, especially in the local church context, which that often, you know, you're struggling and fighting to get men to fill leadership roles.
You mentioned the grift issue. We turn discipleship a lot of times into just another piece of the managerial state that we just execute within the church. It becomes incredibly programmatic and assembly line, and then it's very difficult in that to see the differences between male and female spirituality, because everything gets very egalitarian in that context. And I think the struggle, at least I'm in Dallas, and even down here in the quote unquote Bible Belt, it is a hurdle to impose the idea upon the people that the differences in men and women are good and by design, that is the ultimate diversity, right? And it's a difficult thing. I mean, my church just started having women read the scripture passages, and I'm just, you know, that's not what we're talking about today, but discipleship is absolutely gender specific, and without that, you just get you get this egalitarian mess that really isn't discipleship. It might just be another Bible study or something.
Tagging off of that, you know, I think that it comes about best, at least in my experience, when these form kind of organically within churches, when you'll have just men who have a natural tendency towards leadership. But it really happens in a very informal friend, family association kind of thing. But it is understood that, you know, you don't form cliques within the church. We're a small church, so... And the church I grew up in was also a small church. So we had like kind of the benefits of that. It wasn't like large enough. And I go to some of these mega churches and it's like people will never know each other within the church because it's such a mass amount of people. But unfortunately that's the kind of evangelical church that most people have exposure to just by sheer number in America today. And it's so programmatic. And the thing that gets me is like, it's very much, you have this professional staff that is talking down to people. No one really seems to want to listen or to really have a, like a genuine human connection. I mean, there was one I went just, you know, a family member just to do the whole thing of, you know, going to this event together. It's like, all right, I'll go to this, even though I know the whole time I'm going to be gritting my teeth. The pastor had said at the end, though, you know, if you've found Jesus in this service, please grab one of these canvas tote bags on the way out that has a new convert package in it. And to me, that was just one of the most horrifying things. I would rather that, you know, just go ahead and be a heathen, you know, instead of going that route. It's just, it blew my mind. And I'm just like, I feel like a dinosaur in today's church world. But looping back around to the first question real quick, too, I think it's also important to understand that it's not just male and female, but it's masculine and feminine modes of spirituality, and that within each person, there's going to be a mix of that, right? Like you don't want your women to be entirely doing the intuitive feminine approach to spirituality. They need, you know, the appreciation for the rules and the masculine sort of religious strength, of the masculine polarity of that, right? But you also don't want to be you don't want to have men who are totally stripped out from having a kind of intuitive or a deeper connection to that. I mean, kind of hard to explain, but there's a reason why women throughout so much of history had been oracles and mystics and fulfilled all these other roles in many different religions, but including Christianity. And, you know, seeing it in my own parents' relationship to each other as a Christian mother and father and leaders of a family, you know, my mom just had this incredible intuition about people. You know, she had the gift of discernment, and she was able to pick up that there were, you know, pastors or prominent men within fellowships that had serious, serious problems that were, you know, hidden under the surface, and, you know, kind of was able, you know, guide my dad in a certain sense of, you know, you need to be very careful around this person, and, you know, you need to, avoid any associations or having him, you know, come preach at our church or this kind of thing. And then a couple of years later, you just most horrific scandal emerges about this person. It's like, wow, you know, that was a real help meet situation for my dad, that, you know, he was, he had a wife with a very strong, sense of, spiritual, discernment and intuition that was able to see these things, you know. And I think that's it's very ideal kind of marriages when you have a man and a woman who are both able to pull from their respective strengths, right? The woman from the feminine and the man from the masculine, and really form a joint unit there that, you know, they help each other. And there's a very strong combination for leadership potential right there. But of course, you know, within the confines of the rules of the of what's proper and this kind of thing, which, yeah, I've seen plenty of cases where you have like pastors' wives totally running the shows in churches, and really that, you know, you could tell they had their husband under their thumb. But in a lot of other cases where you have a pastor's wife who was not seeking the limelight, not seeing this or that, but really was there to be a partner in the ministry, to support her husband, that is a beautiful thing. And, you know, I think we're in today's church world, you just see so much tendency towards the former, though, right? This kind of need to be on the stage, need to have like the doctor title in front of whatever her name is, and all this sort of stuff. So,
girl boss.
Yeah. I mean, it has seeped into the church. I saw a clip the other day. I don't know why the algorithm decides to torture me with these heresies. But it was this woman talking about how, you know, she come to realize later that God sent her her divorce to ultimately prosper her. You know, it was just talking about in very material terms about how she had to move in with her parents and, you know, her room was small and she was doing makeup at Nordstrom, but how if she hadn't got rid of that man, she would have never been able to build her career as a preacher.
Wow.
And, you know, in these very blatant terms of like, she was not really hiding the fact that she was a motivational speaker masquerading as a minister and that this was bringing her a lot of money.
Yeah, could I piggyback off that? Because I honestly, I see that, this issue of the role of the genders as being, I don't want to say everything, but it is so absolutely important, because that's especially where I see, for instance, the youth critiquing the Christian faith, like, entirely, is they see it as just a kind of road to effeminacy. And, I mean, unless and until we can find a way to fix that, it's difficult for me to see many ways forward that are going to be productive. Because it's exactly as you guys have mentioned already, this tendency towards the egalitarianism. And, you know, we face everything going, like, trying to establish the role, the manly role of things. And I think a phrase that Ben used right there that is so incredibly helpful is, just think of all the beautiful things that come from when men are men and women are women, instead of trying to level the playing field, right? I mean, these traditional roles have sustained us as a people for so long. And so many beautiful things have come from that. And I don't see, when I see, for instance, the, like what you guys had mentioned, sort of the girl boss phenomena, or exactly like what Ben was saying. I mean, I see that all the time, where it's the women who are, in many ways, it seems like they've just appropriated Christianity to become these kinds of motivational speakers. And that is just, you can't describe that with the word beautiful. I mean, there's plenty of words to describe it, but you cannot describe that with beautiful. And certainly not within, I don't believe in any way, the confines of the Christian faith. And so that was also what really piqued my interest with the list that Kruptos had mentioned in discussing this particular episode with us about the men's spaces and the women's spaces and stuff, because I think it's all part of that larger puzzle right there. And I mean, as far as leadership goes, men have to be men. I mean, in the Christian faith, because to right the ship at this point of the way in which people see Christian men as effeminate. I mean, look, I know I'm speaking to the choir right here that, you know, we know that that's not true. However, if you look at the larger tendency of things, you can't help but say, you know, there's something to it, and it's frightening.
So. Well, I think a huge part of this is the church model that kind of dominates, particularly in the United States, right? So if you look at this typical situation you see in the United States with a very professional ministerial class and not much to the church besides what goes on Sunday and maybe like people meeting for coffee as like a Bible study once a week. If you looked at that as a 25-year-old man and said, you know, what does my success look like in this community? What does it look like for me when I'm 35 or 40 to have succeeded in this community? You just look at that and you don't see everything about yourself that looks like success at 25 is not expressed in that community. There's no logical place for it. And so I think a big challenge in discipleship of young men is trying to create spaces for them to become successful, high-status men that have a natural place in that church community. Some of that, I think, comes out of deprofessionalizing some of the ministerial role. I think successful men in your community should feel that they have a role to be part of doing ministry to younger people in the church. I think that's an essential piece. But part of it comes from expanding the church community from kind of a community that meets together to, you know, sing and be taught to a community that does the rest of life together, where you'll find roles for, where you'll find social roles for successful Christian businessmen. You'll find social roles for successful adult men who become teachers in the community for other skills. Who you go down the list, but the issue is, if the church community is constrained to religious teaching on Sunday, then it's very, very difficult to construct proper roles for successful men in it. There are a very small number of them. Whereas if the church is a complete community, then young men can see themselves as having all of these other social roles within the context of that church, right?
Yeah. One of the things that has been rattling around in the back of my mind has been Walter Ong's book. Now, he is a Catholic Jesuit, and he wrote about the differences between male and female, just in a sense of trying to understand some of those issues. One of the things that Elul notes, or not Elul, that Ong notes, is that women just are, because they're born from their mothers, they're the same as their mothers, and so what a woman is almost a sense the woman just is. And so I think when we talk about female spirituality or the female dominating the church, is that I think what you made me think of this Black Horse was this idea that we're just being. Like, so there's, as a man who's in his 20s, looks at it and thinks, I'm going to be the same in my 30s as I am in my 20s. And for a woman, there's probably something that's okay with that, because a woman is being, in a sense, her path of growth or change is different, but and essentially what is a woman is not really a struggle. Whereas a man comes out of a woman and realizes, well, I'm biologically different. I'm under my mother's skirts when I start, you know. And then at a certain point in my life, there begins a process of figuring out what a man is. And that means sort of breaking away from his mother, breaking away from the feminine. And so part of the old rituals of, you know, becoming a man, the ceremonies, you know, that you go on, you know, you're trained and then you're made ready and you go on this hunt, or there's some task that you have to overcome. And there's the sense that men need to separate. And within sort of male psyche, there is this sense of bonding but distance, you know, in a sense where guys get together and they spend time wrestling and punching because you can't get too close. So you're always keeping distance. There's this sort of sense of separation. But there's also this sense of hierarchy, of competition always. So you're one up or you're one down. And from a female spirituality sense in our churches, this sort of this egalitarian sense, this idea that somebody is one up or one down, higher or lower, is very anathema. So like to what Black Horse was saying is I can kind of envision a male spirituality where you're in a town and you're building and doing, and you're maybe even working with your hands, where like, oh, that widow down the street who needed a new roof, we did that, right? Yeah. That lady in the back whose porch was falling apart, we rebuilt her deck, you know, these types of things. And you can see the tangible ways in which, and I like Charles Haywood's, you know, the men drive things forward and women bind them together. And as Ben was saying, with, you know, a healthy relationship with a couple, the man leads, but the woman's often doing a lot of the behind the scenes stuff with interpersonal relationships, keeping an eye out for things that he might miss. So there's this kind of cooperation that goes on, but it's always the men who are driving forward. So the questions that maybe we've run ahead of ourselves even a little bit is, in that sense, what does a male spirituality look like with an emphasis on, you know, driving forward, hierarchy, competition and combat, where you establish your place in a hierarchy by besting other males, these types of things.
I think at a very basic level, a male spirituality only properly exists in a proper, in an independent male hierarchy within the community, right? Which is part of what I was getting at. Like, if that church is the whole community, then you can go out and as a young man and you can rise to the top of that hierarchy or establish yourself as of value within it. Whereas if the church is just this kind of ghettoized part of your life for education and maybe like
personal satisfaction.
Yeah. There's no place for men in that world. Right.
I mean, I think in one sense though, that a big thing is that, women have become denatured, including within many churches, from their real nature, which, you know, I don't see them as being so much static or just existing, but really as a conduit for creation, right? And you see this in their role as mothers.
That's a good way to put it.
Bringing new life into the world. And I think that, you know, for women, like, as Welbeck put it, love is power. It's this generative tectonic force that is this like pure will that when that is properly ordered and channeled in the right direction, it becomes very inspiring for men around them. I think that, you know, these types of women, they really inspire men around them to become more than they are, right? I think men can exist in this kind of static stagnation and really a kind of bleakness, and that it's a lot of it's like the machinations of women that motivate them, you know, motivate us to get up and go chase the gazelle and feed the family.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a certain back and forth that you can't really, I don't think you can really fully divorce the one from the other in terms of going about fixing the problem. I think if you know, you can try to fix the men, and a lot of that has been happening. And there's been, pretty big shift of young men to the church, to spirituality, this sort of thing. But I think as long as it's an uphill battle, as long as there's like this massive cohort of women that are not really in the culture, like they don't really feel like they can just be women like women have been throughout most of history. There is this kind of pressure for them to conform to the dominant model, right? I mean, I've known a lot of girls who they had no real interest in college and career. Like they just wanted to, maybe graduate high school, date and marry pretty quickly, and you know, set about to building a home and a family. But their parents had, very often the mother too, would have bigger ambitions for them and would push them. And there were a lot of girls I remember in college who were just deathly unhappy with what they were doing, and as a consequence, I engaged in a lot of the negative social behaviors that have been a hallmark of all of this. But you know, I think that on the aggregate level, women have been failed in a massive way. Girls have, by just not being shown proper leadership and instead being channeled into careers and feminism and all these sort of things that they found themselves in. So it's kind of like you gotta juggle, right? You gotta be doing something on one side to be fixing this problem, so that you can have women who are going to inspire the men to become something more than what they are.
Well, it makes me think too of Peter Laslett's The Land That We Lost, this idea that back prior to industrialization, a woman's role was very different as well too, because society was organized into what he called households. And so the woman in the household was, she was, you know, mother, matriarch. She gave birth to children and raised them, but she was also part of an enterprise. So she was in many ways, you know, the behind the scenes person doing and managing a lot of the stuff that made either the farm or the shop or the small business run and hum. And so there was a whole range of activities from education to even like nursing and, you know, curing the sick to taking care of certain aspects of the business behind the scenes. So I wonder if part of the thing
this is what I mean by recovering the whole community, right? Because that model means that the entire business of the entire productive enterprise is contained within the community. In a lot of the cases in the pre-industrial world, it's contained within the single family or the extended family group. But all of the possible kind of what you've done is you've created a hierarchy down at a human scale that both men and women can kind of slot into at different places
and have natural roles within it.
The biggest problem I see for young men is you're 25. Okay, what does success look like? Well, success looks like moving to Manhattan and making $1 million, right? You in the church say, no, that's not success. You won't have a family, whatever. But what are you holding out in front of them as the alternate good that they're supposed to pursue? This is the big struggle for the American church is creating proper roles for men within their community.
What is aspirational in our community for men?
Exactly.
And also, too, is like what level of paternalism exists within the church, right? I think some of the most successful religions or churches, like it would be one example I'd point to is if you look at the unemployment rate in Utah during the Great Recession, you would think there was no recession at all because the Mormons did a very good job of making sure that people weren't out of work within their community. You know, they saw their obligations to each other as being more than just social or religious, but also material. And you see this, I think, also among the Mennonite groups, among Amish, Beachy Amish, etc., where there's a great interest in setting the young men up financially so that they can afford to have a run a family with a single income.
It's an active process.
Yeah. And so like within my own church, it's always been a thing like the older men, like the boomers that everyone complains about, they'd be the ones to be like, all right, how do we get this, 19-year-old like up on his feet and, started in a strong enterprise. So a in-group favoritism is what it boils down to.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I was just going to say, I want to get back to something Ben said earlier that I thought was so important is that on the topic of getting back focused on discipleship and how that dovetails with just church leadership in general, I think a lot of times in the Protestant church, specifically, we and in the more Puritan strain, we expect everybody to be an elder, so because it's a pure church, as opposed to realizing that not only is this functional hierarchy in the family between the sexes and the gender roles, and as Ben said, this masculine the aspects of masculine and femininity, but also that. That there is diversity within the church with respect to the ability to lead, and these guys just exist naturally. I disciple usually right. I've got between 5 and 8 guys that I'm dealing that are at some level of discipleship at all times, and it's purely organic, and this goes from high school and college kids who come and say, hey, I just want to be mentored And that's easy to guys who are, who may be just 10 years or 5 years behind me in life, but they, and you're just, you are naturally wrestling with God and His Word and being faithful together. You're just ahead of the game. You've lived a little bit more. And we absolutely have to have the structure and it within our churches to foster this organic growth. You've got to make sure the soil is tilled and it's watered. And but that is in a professional Christianity mega church environment that we've, that again in the States especially that we find ourselves in, that is threatening to the professional Christian class. I had a Sunday school class back 15 years ago of over 200 people that met in the big fellowship hall and all this. And I had one of the associate pastors basically take the class down because it was a threat. And we actually get along fine now. That's not the point, but this, if you're doing this right, you've got to realize men are going to rise up who are natural leaders, who are given to, taking men along with them. It's that organic piece that Ben mentioned is so important.
Yeah, and I would contrast that with what has essentially been the rise of a professional managerial class within Protestantism in America.
100%, Ben.
Where your leadership is done as like under HR rules. You know, it's a hiring process, and they're subject to the deacons, and all the deacons are subject to their wives. Instead of just letting yes. the stuff merge, yeah, or you know the score as well as I do. Who really runs the boards?
But that's not the bad thing, though. In a healthy like church society.
Well, if they have the right impulse, you know, I have seen it actually where the women sometimes are the stronger advocates for the young men. But it's rare, I think, that is the case, but. Yeah, I mean, there has to be a certain level of control and subjection of authority for who is having the leadership roles, particularly when it comes to doctrine and that sort of thing. So there has to be some level of control. But I think what we have instead is this pantomiming of a kind of corporate culture in which the church staff, right? It's such a professionalized thing. That you really have the same kind of tendencies that creep into any bureaucratic organization.
It's unbelievable how similar a typical American church hierarchy is to a typical corporate American hierarchy to a typical like municipal like city water hierarchy, right?
All bureaucracy is bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our session is, gosh, I hope they're not listening. and I love my church. Been there for 25 years, and very happy. But our session is a corporate board for the most part. There's 16, as opposed to the model of recognizing those who are naturally presbyteros, the elders, the episkopos, the overseers. It is, and this exactly what you mentioned, it's this application corporate process where you rise through the ranks. And, you know, down here, I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with Young Life, but it's very much this para, you know, it's the model of, like American politics, have you done enough to show that you can possibly get things done in a corporate sense, but have you also really made sure to not offend anybody, especially the women? And it's just kind of gross, because then you get guys who, you know, golly, I am going to get in trouble, but it's fine. Like we had some guys decide they wanted a columbarium at our church. And, you know, I know that burial is expensive and all this, but it's our church is incredibly wealthy. Our budget is over $15 million. And we could easily go buy a chunk of land and provide for burial for everyone who died, who was a faithful, giving, attending member of the church. Instead, you know, we have some elders who, not knowing just historical theology and tradition, want to incinerate folks and then keep them forever on the church ground, memorialized. And so you get this, and why, and forget the theological arguments on one side or the other. The reason that happened is that they saw a demand, and here's a product we can have to fulfill that demand. It was completely managerial, completely corporate. And so so golly, I'm going to get calls. Yeah. But
the other thing we have going on too is what do CEOs have to do? They have to show profits to shareholders. And the way that functions within the church is this obsession with growth and getting as many people in as possible, which ends up watering down the gospel, making this not just the doctrine being watered down to ensure that you don't have anyone get offended and leave, but also watering down the very physical attributes of the church, because you have a lot of people who seem to be uncomfortable with the feeling of being in a church that feels like a church. And so you have this drive now all across the country, these churches that you get the bare metal ceilings with the stage lighting and stadium seating. And it's like going to a TED talk.
That's my church basically.
Yeah. But I think it's important we circle back around, like, why are we talking about managerialism? Because we're talking about men's discipleship. I don't think it's random, right?
No, absolutely not.
We're talking about managerialism when we're addressing the problems of discipleship in the church, because managerialism is the antithesis of the construction of hierarchical personal relationships that involve direct personal accountability. Like, one of the things that young men really need in order to grow is they need to be able to be put in a position of authority, and they need to be able to say at the end of a year, I failed or I succeeded at this task. And they need someone older and wiser than them to say, you failed, you succeeded, these are the things you did wrong, these are the things you did right. Rather than have processes that are entirely constructed to prevent accountability that you kind of see in those structures, right?
This is very Marshall Black Horse. We were describing the faithful wife earlier, and you know what it sounds like? It sounds like if you've been in the military, it sounds like an excellent executive officer. It's the one who and the best executive officers make for the best, ultimately, general officers, because they've facilitated and pushed and made better their superior, especially in the Navy. But this is a great wife. Well, similarly, these structures that in the church aren't really corporate; they're martial. Young men having responsibility and a task that they either succeed or fail at, you're describing a platoon commander, or you're describing a young captain. You're describing go take that hill, and you either do or you don't. And if you don't, you know, maybe some guys die. But that's the seriousness of what we're dealing with. And managerialism seeks to both make everything level, but also remove all the risk. We may not take that hill, but at least no one's going to die.
Well, and like all of corporate structure is designed around the fact that if nobody's blamed, then nobody gets fired, right?
Risk management.
And that structure, you know, I understand why that structure exists. Nobody wants to get fired, but it is the worst possible structure for developing young men. It's why I think that all young men should go and if they're not going to be in the military, they should start a business and deal with the realities of what it's like to have a business of less than 10 people, because it's one of the only places in our society that that kind of direct personal accountability exists.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you run a payroll. That's some responsibility.
Well, yeah. Or you have personal clients that you're the one man show. I got like mine is a business where it's me. And that's the nice thing that like we have a household here. My wife does a lot of the back end stuff, the mailings, the nuts and bolts to allow me to just do my work. Right. And I have clients that I service and I'm responsible to them. And if I fail, I get fired, which doesn't happen, but because I don't. But it's one of those things I think to the we're getting, I think, closer and bearing down on some of the nuts and bolts of this idea of male spirituality. Because so egalitarianism is a thing that crushes men. So if you're going to create strong men, you have to not be afraid of men succeeding and standing out. But that also means, this is why I wrote my most recent piece, is that men have to also not be afraid to embrace the burden of being better. Because as soon as you stand out and say, I'm going to pursue God, I'm going to engage in a disciplined prayer life, a disciplined life of scripture reading, a disciplined moral life, I'm going to take care of my body, I'm going to serve in the church, and I'm going to do this intentionally, others will try to pull you down. They just, because if you stand out, you place a moral obligation on them. Well, if he's doing it, now it places an obligation on me to do it. And so there's this sense of men have to, you know, giving men the courage to be better. And I think it begins with us, you know, to say, well, okay, then I'm going to be better in the community. I'm going to be willing to stand out so that others feel the courage to stand, like, hey, it's okay to stand out and to lead. And that you're not necessarily going to get punished for it. Or if you do, you can stand up against it. Well, we have John, the Ron's comment about the military and military training made me think of why I invited you here, Slaughter, is a sense of your recent conversations about your own military experience. And I've always thought that you know, Christian discipleship is something very intentional, and that there should almost be a kind of, well, like football, a two-a-days or like a training camp or a boot camp type of experience with Christian male discipleship. And I think that, you know, if you're engaging in a spiritual war with the evil one, I think lessons from, you know, military training are probably not that far off the mark for male discipleship.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Like when I was talking with Burton, I was explaining to him that you train constantly so that way when you get into a situation, you know how to react to the situation. Because the example I used with him was, you know, the first time I was in a firefight, it's almost intuitive. That training just kicks in. And I think the key is that to start that young. You know, I grew up in a Southern Baptist environment, and none of the men in my family were spiritual. It was always the women, right? Or I wouldn't say spiritual. They were involved in the church. So I didn't grow up in an environment that I ever saw any examples of masculine spirituality whatsoever. So when I went through, you know, when I was in my 20s, I kind of just left Christianity completely. And it wasn't until I got older that I came back to it. And I have two sons now. And what I've made a point to do is to have a regimen of praying with them every night before they go to bed, making them pray, you know, before we have meals. We do scripture readings. We go to church. Obviously, being, you know, Catholic, First Communion, stuff like that was a big deal. But I think, you know, when we talk about discipleship, my personal opinion is that we kind of have to start from the ground up, because what I've noticed is the masculine type of men that are leaders don't want to go into church in the first place, because there's nothing that draws them to the church. I was like that. You know, I wrestled in high school. I said, joined the Marine Corps. And when I looked at church, we used to always joke that all the music directors were gay, right? Because yep. that was the experience I had. So there was nothing there for me. And as I got older, you know, I kind of came to it on my own, and I realized that I've had individuals in my life that are not Christian that have come to me interested in Christianity just from talking with me. And I realize, I think sometimes it's more important to, like you were saying, to build yourself up, to become this type of man that other men want to be, and they'll naturally follow you. And then you can kind of lead those young men into the church, because I think you need those young men in the church in the first place to even start changing things, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah, let me really second what John just said right there. I think that's the key. You've got to give these people something to want to aspire to in your own person. And then when they see, I mean, this is sort of what I mentioned in the group chat the other day. I mean, once they see that whatever it is about yourself that's excellent, that they want for themselves, then they find out about, you know, how principled you are in your faith. And that's going to get them think. That's going to open them up to the possibility that the church might have something for them. Because they're not going to find that walking into any given church on their own or something like that. So I'm really big on my end of things, at least, with emphasizing the role of imitation, right? You never know who's watching you. And so you conduct yourself in a way that gives other people something to sort of have to stop and think about and say, okay, whatever he's doing at a fundamental level, I should probably incorporate it into my life. So
be the kind of person that somebody else would want to emulate.
I also think one of the ways to start as a church for this kind of thing is to start really pushing men at their responsibilities in their family. So, if you were to take a survey in your churches, how many men are leading their family into worship on a daily basis? Are making sure that their children are taught scripture on a daily basis? Are making sure that they're setting that example for spiritual discipline within their own family? And one of the like first things that you can do to promote discipleship within the church is hold men to account for the condition of the thing that they're responsible for. You know, not everyone is at the point where they have a family yet, but these are like fundamental things that these men are obviously responsible. Start acting like they're responsible for them and start evaluating them on how they're handling that responsibility. You know, as an older man in the church, start saying, you know, young man, your young children really seem to know scripture really well. You must be doing a great job at home. And encouraging them in that kind, in a way that builds up their responsibility for the thing that is given to them.
Yeah, rather than guilt or shaming them into, yeah, noticing what they're doing and just giving them the attaboy.
A couple of good examples I had growing up was with youth camps. One was actually when we lived out in California, it was a rodeo youth camp up near Redding. That was a great experience because it blended the discipleship with learning roping and all this cool stuff. That was great. And then there was another one back east, a youth camp up in the mountains where one of the brothers from one of the churches that was part of it was a retired drill instructor. So he had us running up a mountain doing the it was looking like this La Sierra High School fitness program there for a while. And then, you know, that was the morning thing. We go into service, then during the afternoon, play sports and stuff after church then, and then big, powerful night services. And, you know, that was very cool to see, but, you know, thinking back in retrospect, like that took a lot of time and effort and organization for the people to put this on. So I think part of it too, is just, you know, having the people to step out and really shoulder the burden of, putting together, you know, it's a lot programming wise to put something like this together. And I think that, you know, it's like, how do we resist entropy? You know, we see it not just in the church, but in all parts of society, a decline in civic participation, right? You have VFW chapters that are shutting down because the more recent generations of veterans just don't seem to have as much interest in being in a veterans group as, you know, as they did in the days after World War One, World War Two, and Vietnam. So, you know, how do we buck that? But then also, like, how do we identify, like, what is causing this problem of, like, detachment from civic or public life in the country? It seems to be a pretty widespread phenomenon.
I wonder, too, if some of that detachment is just a function of the dehumanizing nature of managerialism. It just doesn't inspire people to be involved. That it's just sort of a function of what we've created, that it's very hard to inspire people to become drones in the machine. And I think that gets back to some of what Black Horse is talking about of, can we create an alternate reality that we're inspired to build something within? I was thinking too about male spirituality and male spaces. Some of the most profound moments that I've had with other men were on canoe trips. And I remember one in particular where we had, I think there was 10 men and their sons, and some of the sons whose fathers couldn't come away. But after you had like a varying skills of canoeing with fathers and both sons together, getting the, you know, fathers and son in the same canoe where neither of them know how to do a canoe, to actually managing it, you know, deftly enough to get where they're going. But then over the course of like a week and a bit, sitting around campfires with no cell phones, nothing to do but basically fish, talk, and eat for a week, and just hanging around other men. I can remember one night very clearly where all the men were sitting around, and one of the guys just sort of blurted out, he said, "I don't know how you guys feel," but he says, "You know, I've always felt like a fraud as a father." And this was a guy who, like, everybody loves. You see, everybody looks at him like he's a great father. His kids are good kids. You know what I mean? And you're like, and then all of a sudden you're like, the whole group, everyone is like, "Oh, I didn't realize that, you know, I thought I was the only one." And so you had this group of men who were just basically bearing it all to each other and talking about things that have been, you know, laying beneath the surface. And it was surprising, the transformation from that point over the week, in terms of these, you know, just watching these men. And I even today, like years later after that canoe trip, where there's a kind of connection with these guys still yet, even though some of them, you only see them once every other year kind of thing, just because of that bond you built of just being men together out in the woods and having nothing but time to just talk about men stuff, I guess. Did I lose everybody?
Sorry. I think you're talking about two separate but equally important things. One is the value of doing difficult things together, and the other is the value of male-only spaces. And I think both are, you know, these are both things there's not a lot of in our culture, and they're both important things for men for a variety of reasons.
Did you have anything that you wanted to add, John?
In regards to the male-only spaces, I think they're extremely important because it's one of the few places men feel comfortable actually being honest. As we've all alluded to, you know, there's this egalitarianism, and part of that, it sort of nerfs what we say because we don't feel comfortable speaking truth. And I think a thing that I've noticed to connect it to discipleship is that a lot of the young guys that I've talked to that are younger than me, they are interested in religion, but when it comes to engaging with it honestly, right? And, you know, it, like an example I was brought up earlier about, you know, having sort of females leading in church, it's quite clear what scripture says about that, but then you can't question that openly, right? And I think these male-only spaces allow for those sort of things to be questioned. And then they allow for men to sort of establish a connection with each other, which they can support each other and then publicly question those things, if that makes sense. And I think that's one of the important aspects of it.
Well, that's it's interesting that you made it, because I tweeted this out a couple of weeks ago, a passage from Walter Ong, where he talks about one of the primary purposes actually of male-only spaces is to actually talk about their difficult relationships with women, in a sense of to complain about women and how women run their lives. And I know it sounds kind of funny and cliche, but there is a certain sense of if men have to define themselves in a sense, almost by being like, we're not women, that, you know, as you gather together with men, part of that forming that men's space is men themselves defining for themselves how they're not women. And then discovering in a sense of, well, if we're not women, what is it that we are? And then if we're figuring out what is it we are, what are we then, not just as men, but as men before God? And how do we then establish ourselves as men before God? And the only way I don't think you can do that in mixed spaces. It really takes men by themselves doing things together as men to establish that you have to separate men out. And that's one of the challenges that we face today, is that there are so few men's spaces because they're seen by women as power centers that need to be broken down, because they allow men to maintain and hold on to hierarchical positions over women. And so there's a political aspect to breaking down male spaces. But part of the reason why men are so adrift is that there's so few male spaces. And that was, again, one thing, like you get to like the Gamergate, right? Where video games became this male space for men. And it was a scandal when women started to invade these spaces and sort of like, do you know what guys are saying and how they're talking in these spaces? And they're like, the guys are like, well, yeah, that's kind of the point of them.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that is a regional thing. You know, I live in...
I don't know if there's anything rural. At this point. We've been at this already for an hour, gentlemen. And I know we said we have lots of time, but... I don't know if there's anything from that list that anybody wants to jump in and talk about, if there's anything left. I mean, we could probably go on for hours just getting into the minutiae of it, and perhaps we'll get off the air and think, oh, we need to do this again. There's something else. I mean, we didn't get a whole lot into sort of physical fitness and males, like what does actual male spiritual discipline look like? These types of things. I don't know if anybody's got anything else they want to add, or we need to take this in a new direction, or are we happy with our first session in this regard? Is my mic on?
We hear you. We're just...
or are people hearing something?
Deep in thought. Something... Deep in thought, Kryptos. I think the physical fitness thing is almost a separate... It's part of discipleship, but it's the way the culture has gone in North America is so haywire with regards to, you know, your body as a temple and that whole theme in scripture. We're instead now the culture is saying you can do whatever you want chemically, physically, you know, it's so weirdly, I don't know if it's hyper-gnostic or what, but it's almost like, because I think the physical fitness thing, that's the one thing that stood out that we haven't really talked about. And I think it's important, but it's almost like this entire other thing that the church has to deal with, which is the importance that while we aren't materialists, our bodies and matter matters, if that makes any sense. And that's you're turning around a battleship, especially, you know, and it's where a lot of Christian women are honestly better than the men on some of this, not in our circles, but if you go and look at, like at my church, most of the women are pretty fit and the men are not. And it's very strange.
Yeah, I was going to add that one of the things I've noticed the most, I don't know I don't know how much time you guys spend lifting and stuff like that, but it's just been amazing the way that you talked about how women came into the spaces of the gamer guys. You should see the gyms.
Oh my goodness, it's brutal. It's just
amazing. And the thing is, I mean, it's like this perfect storm because now, you know, I made that joke about the women's leggings in the gyms in the chat the other day about like sloppy theology. It's like women's leggings at the gym. They can make anything look fit. It is so, I mean, you can't even begin to understand how hypersexualized it is. And not just that, it's become so fashionable for the women because of that, that, I mean, I'm sort of out here at the ground zero of like fitness in America. And there are more women at any given time in the gyms than there are the guys. I mean, we're talking ratio numbers more, at least 3/4, maybe 2/3 or something like that, at least. And in most cases, they're in better shape than the guys, which is amazing to me because they've done that. I think it's because of so much of the social media, right? I mean, all you have to do is be fit, open up an Instagram or a TikTok account and get a couple million followers and then just turn it into a lifestyle and stuff. And women are far more successful about that because of the sexuality element there. But again, I mean, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we could just run down the checklist of how it's just culminated in the fact that it's the fitness element. It's exactly like I think Ronald was saying. It's almost its own discussion.
Well,
I actually think there's
a huge issue here because in particularly American culture, but Western culture more generally, fitness has gotten intimately associated with sexuality instead of intimately associated with competence, right? So if you think about the way that young men in male-only spaces think about somebody who's fit, they associate fitness, strength with competence to achieve difficult things. Whereas outside of that very kind of narrow, you know, I was a competitive wrestler when I was growing up. You didn't think of someone as... You thought of someone as physically competent. You didn't think of someone as like attractive. But that whole structure completely goes away as soon as you leave that very kind of narrow space. I think a big part of why I don't think you can recover physical fitness in the context of proper male spirituality until you recover the body is a functional element instead of the body is like a sexual advertisement.
I was just going to say, it's funny how many times I've heard women condemn yoga in one breath as being Hindu or paganistic while at the same time wearing yoga pants.
Yoga pants. There is, though, too, that and this is the competition where I like to Black Horse point that there is an element in the fitness thing where it's being fit to be virile, to be sexually active. And, you know, the point is to be buff, to attract chicks. And that whole thing is part of that. It is seen as a vital, as living that sort of a disordered vitalism, you might say, and living a embracing the fullness of life means being fit towards that type of pursuit, which I think is, again, there's that whole question of rightly ordered. I think one of the things that has been noodling around in the back of my mind is this word discipline, and that part of, you know, Christian spirituality is relearning sort of a focused discipline of being disciplined toward, not just discipline for the sake of being disciplined as an end in of itself, but discipline towards like a larger goal. And, you know, do we as again, that thing of emulating, do we emulate as men the value of union with Christ? Is that something that we talk about? Is that something as a goal? Now, I've always been a bit of an odd guy. Like when I went to seminary, I got a first-rate education, like world-class. People came to our seminary from all over the globe to have, you know, special years of study and so forth. But when I went to seminary, I, you know, naively had this thing in the back of my mind that it was going to be almost like going off to a monastery and they were going to teach me how to pray and meet the Lord. And I was quickly,
disabused of that notion.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And unfortunately, you have pastors who get out into ministry who are technicians of the word, they're theologians, they're administrators, but their seminary did very little to teach them. They're just assumed that that's what you do. You come in, you don't go to seminary unless you're spiritually mature, right? Whereas a lot of guys are coming to seminary because, well, for one thing, God has nudged them, but they're also coming to fill a hole in their life, and ministry is, subconsciously a way to fill that hole in their life. And so they're looking to be shown and to be led closer to God. And so that's, I think, one of those things is like, what are we directing ourselves to in the sense of we're pursuing excellence? What are we disciplining our lives towards so that others can see and know that it looks like we're actually achieving that we are, you know, we are getting closer to God. We are seeing God. We're embracing wisdom. I'm fit and disciplined. There's a whole layer of characteristics that look down that makes who we are aspirational. Like I can see Kryptos and he looks to me like somebody who's found God. And that's, you know, does somebody else see that in me? And I think those are some of the deeper questions that we need to face, especially as older men, you know, because you look back and think, you know, I've made some mistakes. I've learned some stuff. I've been, you know, I've had successes and failings as a father and so forth. You know, what do I have to offer? And also these things. But yet, you know, that's the beauty of the gospel is it gives you always that opportunity to, pick yourself up and start fresh to say, okay, I've learned a few things in terms of, you know, the practicalities of life. I've made some failings, but am I ready to disciple somebody else? And if I'm not, what do I need to do to get to there? And that's maybe the first question we need to ask. What do I need to do to get myself into a position where I'm capable of discipling somebody else?
What's the modern version of the camel's knees that James was known for because he was praying all the time? You know, what is it that folks are going to see that manifests the life of a disciple? And that's a great question. And as I get older, it's harder for me to answer sometimes because I find myself I have to ask the younger guys sometimes, okay, wait a minute, how do you think about this? Anyway, I think that's a really great thought to have in your mind is what is it that marks you as not just one who goes to church or not just one who's bowed the knee, but one who is actively pursuing discipleship, the discipleship of Christ? It's a great question.
I was wondering, Harris, if you had anything to add to this. I know you've been listening thoughtfully there for some time. If you wanted to chime in and say something.
Well, I kind of joined late and I've never been part of one of these discussions. So I'm just sheepishly kind of in the background. And I think I might be the youngest one, although I don't see everyone's face. So
if you're younger than 36, that might be the case.
Yeah. So maybe, someone's a year and a half older than me than the next youngest person, but I'm just absorbing all this wisdom. And I did have one story I thought might intrigue you from my church, really. So I go to a church that's kind of MacArthurite, I guess you could say. And growing up, like in the 90s and early 2000s, the male spaces were like you had two options. You had teaching, men's Bible study, that kind of thing. And then there were leisure activities like church picnics and potlucks and things, the men would always go play volleyball. It was a tradition, really. There was also male softball, but I remember the volleyball standing out. So I think it was like 11 or 12. The men always like regulated who was able to play. So it was a real competition, right? So you couldn't be a boy and compete with them. And of course, there's safety concerns there. Well, this one year around that time, there was a kid who was in his early teens that really wanted to play volleyball with the men. And he started crying about it, which, you know, goes to show you how much of a man he was. He was whining about how they wouldn't let him play volleyball. Well, his mother comes out on the court and starts just berating the guy you could effectively say was the leader of organizing the volleyball. And he caved to it. And he let the kid come and play. He didn't have much to say to the mom. And all the men just kind of left. And then the kids started playing volleyball. Well, to this day, whenever there's an event and volleyball, you know, the volleyball's brought out and there's a net and everything, the men do not play. And I saw it killed in one incident over a decade ago. And I just kind of consider that a really huge hit to the church, personally, like my church, as far as like male interaction. And the only place I guess I've seen it recovered is with myself and other friends who organically will meet up to go hike and that kind of thing together. And that's, I guess, brought some of that back. But I guess just a lesson, and I don't know what that means, like if that's a larger social thing going on or like what happened, but I'm going to have these fond memories when I'm older of, hey, yeah, the men used to really have a great time competing with one another and saying, you know, insulting things that were taken well to each other and being men together. And now that doesn't happen. So figure I throw that out there.
That's not unheard of or uncommon. But it also says the value too of boys looking at the men playing. It goes back to sort of older tribal things where the men sit at the front, you know, around the fire, and the boys sit in sort of behind them, whatever, and the men tell stories and whatever. And then the boys just kind of listen and they don't say anything, but they just listen and they watch. And eventually their turn comes. And so you know, if the men are playing volleyball, you know, the boys can watch on the side. But then when the men wrap it up, the boys will then come onto the court to imitate the men that they just saw play. And that's natural and good. And, you know, having the courage to say that to a shrieking woman, take some courage, but you know, these are the types of things that men need to step up and do and to say, no, this is a good thing that we're doing here. And your son will get a turn to play later, but this is our space right now. You know, he can play later when we're done. And then that just boom, and just leave it at that. And I guess that's perhaps the other thing is that men do have to have some courage to assert male only space. I have a similar story where young divorcee, canoe trip, she wanted to take the role of the now departed father and to join her son on this father-son canoe trip. And people thought, you know, because it had been a very recent divorce, and so the male leadership acquiesced, and it was a disaster because it completely messed up the whole weekend. Nobody would talk differently around her. They all, you know, there was no male space at all. And she meant well, but the next year when it came up, she tried to sign up, and one of the leaders had the courage to say, I know that what you're doing, we appreciate your desire to want to spend time with your son and to fill the role of your father, but you being here completely messes up the space, and he needs to be around all men, and we'll take care of him. You just go and enjoy, you know, a few days by yourself. And she thankfully had the grace to not press it and acquiesce it, and it was phenomenal for this boy to be in this all male space, and was a real blessing for him over several years. So I think it's one of those things that we have to be willing to assert the value of maleness in our churches in a healthy way. And to say that it's good to be man. It's good to aspire to things that are excellent. It's good to have hierarchy. It's good for us to evidence excellence and not be afraid to stand out for it. And it's good to have male only spaces that aren't just, you know, men's prayer breakfast, that are other things. And this is fine. And it's good to say that, well, as much as you'd like to come and join us, young lady, I'm sorry, but this is something that we are men are doing. So it looks like we're pretty much ready to wrap up. I thank you all, Black Horse, Ben, Ron, Athenian, John, and John, for joining us. I'm sure that, you know, once we're done here, we'll think of things we could or should have said. And I think that this is, again, one of these topics that now that we've broached it a little bit, I'm hoping that we'll come back and circle back to it another time and have some fresh things to add to what we've begun here. So again, thank you, gentlemen, and have a great day. Hey.